Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. We're here this morning to focus in on benefits, financial planning, thrift savings, touch on the Roth TSP that's to come, but the focus here is on one's early stages of their federal career. And to lead us in that discussion is federal benefit expert, financial, he knows his finances because he's an economist at heart. And his name is Dave Redden. Good morning, Dave.
Hey, good morning, Bob. Great to see you.
It has been a long time. Have you ever been on the show?
Yeah, it was a long time ago. Yeah, it was a long time ago. Yeah, but it's been a while.
It isn't like I don't know Dave. I've probably known Dave as long as anybody at NITP.
Yeah. 28 years. Oh, my goodness, a long time.
Yeah, I'm back when we were three. And John Elliott, federal benefit strategist, retired Fed, retired seminar presenter, but still comes on the show and graces us with his knowledge. Good morning, John.
Morning, Bob and Dave.
Good morning, John.
Been a few weeks for you as well, and Andrew is running the board, so call Andrew, and I didn't say hi. Good morning, Andrew. But anyway, give Andrew a call, and he'll run it into us. We're at 202-465-3080. 202-465-3080. Okay, Dave, I'm going to join the federal government. No, I work for the federal government, and I'm a newbie. I just started. Now, let's forget that I'm my age I am. Let's just pretend I'm in my 20s.
Aren't you, Bob?
Thank you. All right. So what should I be looking at? I know I've got a job that I like. I've got security. I've got this thrift savings thing. But what should I be looking at beyond there? I just got out of school, and I have a propensity probably to want to spend money things that I didn't have before, but not say for the things that I should in the future.
Right.
Well, this is really a loaded comment. But what could I look for? Let's do the, I won't say the easy part. I don't understand this stuff. You and John do. What do I look forward to maximize my benefits over the years? I'm not going to do it in the first year or two, but, you know, if I'm looking downstream, what I have in the back of my mind that I heard Dave and John talk about on February 27th, 2012.
Well, you know, oftentimes a federal employee that comes on new is going to be totally overwhelmed with everything. I mean, from the very first day on the job, all the forms that have to be filled out, all the people you have to meet. This is your boss. This is your boss's boss. This is someone who's not your boss, but, you know, they're still going to be pretty important, so you don't want to make them mad. And there's just so much stuff. And then, of course, there's the forms that deal with the payroll. And then sooner or later, you wind up getting a paycheck and you go, I don't know what's going on here, you know, so tell me some things about this. What should I do? Oftentimes, I find that we could sit down and try to dissect the benefits, and we do that oftentimes in many seminars for newer employees, and that's a good thing to do. But it's still the overwhelming feeling of, where am I? How am I going to get there? Is this going to take forever? I mean, can I be rich and retired by, say, 32 or 33 years old? And that's what the lottery's for. That's the fourth tier of FERS, is the lottery winnings, of course. But the idea would be, I need a starting point, and I find one of the best starting points to be, if you go to the TSP website and you go to the calculator section, it's called Planning and Tools on the TSP website, click on calculators and it says, how much do I need to save? It actually exits you out of the TSP website over to the Employee Benefit Research Institute's ballpark estimate. And the ballpark estimate is a really, really simple way to get some validation of, well, how much do I need to be putting in this TSP in order to be able to make a go of it? Now, of course, OPM has gotten into it as well, and they have a link off of their website. It says federal employee version of the ballpark estimate. But it does require significant more knowledge on the part of the employee, knowledge that they may not have initially until they've actually taken a seminar through NITP or from their agency about how their benefits work. But until that time, the ballpark estimate says, okay, if you are going to work for about this many years and you save about this much per year, you're going to make it. And it's very conservative. It's extremely conservative. And you can fine tune that. Now, once you have done that, you say, okay, well, I need to be saving, you know, maybe 5% of my pay. And of course, if you're first in the thrift savings plan, if you put in five, you get five in total government matching funds, you know, the automatic and the matching. So you wind up with 10% of your pay going in. And as long as you have a good long-term investment strategy, that's going to pan out rather well. Next stage is
let me make sure I understand this, Dave. I just started, and I know I'm going to have to take 5% of my pay out of my pocket that maybe I don't want to do, but I'm listening to Dave because he knows. And then what I just heard is Uncle is going to kick in an equal amount, up to 5%.
This is true.
And it's not costing me anything. So I've made 100% on my money.
Right.
The minute it left my pocket.
In a sense, that's correct, Bob. That's a good way to look at it is if I put in five, I'm going to get five more in addition. Five will get me 10. And ordinarily, that's just awesome. Now, the federal government decided that there were too many people that were too confused at the beginning of their career, and they wouldn't do anything, and they got used to the paycheck with nothing coming out for the thrift. And so then they would have to bite the bullet. So a couple of years ago, back in June of 2009, they changed the rules. It didn't go in effect until 2010. But what it says now is that an individual that starts new automatically gets enrolled at 3% of their pay into the TSP. Now, if someone puts in 3%, then they get 1% automatic contribution from their agency, plus dollar-for-dollar matching on the 3%. So 3% contribution actually has 7% going into the account, which is pretty nice.
Yeah.
Now, then an individual gets 50% matching on the remaining 2%. They can certainly put in a lot more than that. But I always like, if you put in five, you get five. And as you said, that's like 100% rate of return instantly.
Does that, if you're in that situation, does they put it in the G fund, though?
Right. So you have to.
Which is not a good long-term strategy.
No, that's not a good long-term strategy, but at least you're doing something. And the more important thing is if they do this automatically, even though this is in the category of, well, I guess they fooled me a little bit, you don't notice the money that you've never seen. So if you get in that 3% automatic contribution, your paycheck, when you get it, you say, okay, well, this is what I've got. So now I got to pay my bills and I got to do this and that and the other thing. And I guess there's only going to be one trip to Starbucks this time. That's not a commercial for Starbucks, by the way. At any rate, so the idea would be that the individual manages the money that they see coming into their bank account. And this way, they didn't have to voluntarily sign up to take a hit in their pay.
Could I ask you a question?
Sure.
After listening to this show, some people listening are going to go, gee, because we're going to talk about this later, not now, that 3% or whatever that goes into the G automatically, do I, as the new federal employee, have the ability to transfer it out of the G into some other fund?
Absolutely. It does require the acknowledgement of risk to be signed, which is not a big deal. But the important thing is that an individual needs to get involved with it first. And that's why Congress passed the law, at the Thrift Board's recommendation, of course, to start an automatic program where employees would be automatically enrolled. Now, the employee that doesn't want to do this at any time can drop out of it. Now, I don't think that's a very smart idea for them to drop out of the contributions in the thrift. But if they want to, they can drop out of it. But I like, here's the one I like, Bob, that they can actually say, no, are you kidding me? 3%? I want to put in 5. And they can do that at any time. That's very easy to do. And once an individual, of course, when they become a federal employee, they're going to get a lot of email accounts, passwords, user IDs, et cetera. And they have to manage all that and not write them down, of course, especially in their smartphone.
Okay.
An individual will be able to go onto the TSP website once they have their account number, and they'll be able to make changes on the fly.
Okay, could I ask you another question?
Sure.
Because now my money's in the G fund. I'm listening to you,
right.
and you said that I can move it out, but I have to sign a form that says I'm going to associate this money with risk.
Right.
Now, anytime people hear risk, they generally push back.
Of course.
But let's not define risk overall. Let's define risk within the TSP.
Sure.
Within the TSP, if I'm not mistaken, there's certain buckets you can put the money in. One
right.
being the risk-free that is the G
right.
fund, and moderate risk-free might be the F fund, although it fluctuates. And what are the other ones?
International? Well, there are five total funds, and then there are combinations of the five funds. The five funds are the G Fund, which is a government security index fund, which actually doesn't really exist anywhere else. It is unique to the thrift. It can never be zero or negative. It's always positive, and it's a special Department of Treasury interest rate, which is really sweet. But as John pointed out a few minutes ago, not good for super long-term investing. A better one for the younger employee would be to get into the American stock market. And there are two different funds for that, the C Fund and the S Fund. The C Fund is the good old standard bellwether S&P 500 index fund that everyone hears reported on the news every single night, every business day. The S Fund, in a sense, is the rest of the American stock market, would be the easiest way to look at it. Smaller companies than the large ones that are in the S&P 500. And so therefore, most people would perceive this, that a smaller company would be inherently more risky than a large company. Well, here's the economics that comes out of me, of course. And in order for this to be efficient, the only reason you would take more risk is if there's more potential for reward. And if you look at very long-term trends, the S fund would outperform the C fund over the very long haul. The fact is that we have to mitigate the extra risk of smaller companies with larger expected rate of returns. Now, you know, we don't want to break this in an economics class because we know that a lot of the new employees out there took economics just a little while ago in school, and many of them hated it, of course. That's because they didn't have me as a professor, of course, Bob, or you.
The best lesson I ever got was from an economics, and I didn't understand it when I was in school. They talked about supply and demand, and demand sounded harsh. I said, I don't want anything. And then they used this analogy. You go to a bar, and what do they have in front of you? They have peanuts and pretzels. What's on peanuts and pretzels? Salt. Right. What does salt do? It generates demand for liquid, beer. And then I understood it.
I never had any beer when I was in college.
No, that's because the prior night you drank it all dry.
Oh, that's what happened. All right.
Anyway, let's get back to it.
So there are two other funds that are in the Thrift Savings Plan arsenal, I guess we'll say. One is an international stock index. It follows a long-standing index that was created more by the American financial community in the 1960s, known as the EAFE, the European, Australasia, Far Eastern Stock Exchanges, which is made up of 21 different countries, and they take a statistical sample of a number of the stocks in those countries' stock indices and their markets. And it's an interesting thing. It does suffer from a type of risk that a lot of people would be pretty cognizant of these days, and that is it suffers from currency or exchange rate risk. Now, the question is, if I take more risk, do I not have to get more reward for this to be efficient? And the answer is yes. And the question is, do I get more reward over the long haul in something like the I Fund versus the American stock market? And statistics would not bear that out. Statistics would say, no, you'd actually do better in the long term, historically now, in the C fund and the S fund than you would in the I fund. But, you know, some people like to spread their money out. The last fund is called the F fund. It's a bond index fund. Now, bond index funds are very interesting. And if you were in some other organization that did not have a G fund, a bond index fund might be a good component to try to mitigate some of the market risk in stocks. However, federal employees have the G Fund, which doesn't exist anywhere else, and may be an okay substitute to use for something that could be a little bit more volatile. Let me give you a for instance. Bond index funds are very sensitive to interest rate movements. Now, interest rates are historic lows right now in the United States, and they've been fairly flat. So we've seen that as the interest rates fell, the F Fund did well. Why? That's because bonds always move in the opposite direction of interest rates. Bond prices and interest rates are what we call inversely related. It's what I've always called the seesaw effect. When one side goes up, the other side must go down. It's a law of financial physics. It's pretty straightforward.
So right now, the F Fund would be a good investment. In fact, for the last decade, where we've had these two bad stock, 3 years or more of 6 years total of, well, not quite, of bad stock markets, The F fund outperformed the other four funds during the first decade of this century.
Because interest rates were falling.
Yeah. Because interest rates were very low.
Yeah. And John's doing a great example of what we would call an active investor right now. An active investor, someone that understands the markets and knows where to put their money at what time and hopefully when to get it out.
But the mistake a lot of people make is when the market goes down, they panic.
Oh.
And they take their money out of stocks.
Right.
And then stocks, as they inevitably do, sometimes it takes a long time, like the downturn at the beginning of this century. Starting in 2000, the stocks didn't start moving back up, if I recall, till March of 2003. But then they went gangbusters. The rest of 2003 was amazing, and subsequent years after that were very good, too, until we got to, what, 2008. But that's roared back. The depressed market in 2008, what was the Dow? Not, we use the Dow in the Feds, but it's a good indicator. The Dow was 6,000. I forget what the S&P fell to, but I've made all my money back by not panicking and bailing out of the stock market.
Right. There's some classic cases. In fact, a great one that I like to point out to seminar participants that I got courtesy of the Thrift Board is that in 1998 was a very interesting year because in the 1990s, the stock market was roaring and you could have thrown five darts at a listing of stocks on the Wall Street Journal and they all would have been winners. And you would have looked like a genius. And then later you would have been broke, of course. But in any event, 1998, the market did a hiccup in the summertime. Well, back in those days, the Thrift Board did month-end valuation. So whatever you told them to move, if you were going to do an interfund transfer, moving your money around funds, they didn't execute it to the end of the month. Market did a big hiccup. It dropped down in the summer of 1998. A lot of people bailed, and it turns out the timing, they bailed about at the bottom. And then once the market came roaring back through the end of 1998, they then decided, well, the market's back up. I'll get back in. For those people, they took about a minus 3% rate of return for the year. Had they left it in, they would have had a 28.5% rate of return. That's how you take a really great year and actively manage it into a pretty rotten year. So John's point about buy and hold, particularly in stocks, is a great, great strategy. And when you're a young person,
It's critical
that you get in and stay in because, number one, this is a retirement plan. The IRS will wipe you out if you try to touch that money too early. So you know you're in it for the long haul. And once you add time into an investment strategy, you can mitigate much of the short-term risk that we would see. This is not as true with the F fund. If interest rates start going up again in the future, and when interest rates go up, the F fund will go down, and you really will take those losses at that point in time because they really do buy and sell those bonds, and they're matching an index. And when you sell a bond before its maturity date, if you sell it for a loss, and if interest rates have risen, then you really do take the loss. With stocks, you're holding on to the stocks. You look at the value of that share price, and it may be down now, but as long as you, so to speak, held the paper, and when it comes back up, you lost nothing. You know, there's one other quick point I want to make. You know, the markets have been, volatile and maybe not so great, a little flat. But dividends now on large companies have been awesome. And we're seeing dividend rates 3, 4, 5% from big companies. They're making record profits. Their share price hasn't reflected it as much, but the dividends are out there. And dividends do get incorporated into your C fund as well as S fund. Many of the small companies in the S fund don't pay dividends at this time, but they certainly do in the C fund, in the S&P 500.
And the dividends then would stay in the fund so that we would get more shares?
Yes, in a sense, what happens is when the dividends are paid back into the fund, then they buy more shares at whatever the prices are at that time.
So obviously, if the market's low,
you're buying more shares right.
Because prices are low,
right?
Okay.
Which is an advantage
and,
once the market corrects itself.
Can I ask you another question? You keep using the term index. Yeah. What's an index?
An index is a representation of a portion of the financial sector of the economy, of a financial sector of the economy. For example, the index that we set as the bellwether, the S&P 500, is in a sense, it's not exactly, but it's in a sense the 500 largest companies that are publicly owned in America. So this is going to be, for example, Boeing, and it's going to be McDonald's, and it's going to be Apple, and it's going to be Microsoft, and it's going to be Walmart. And then when we get into the S fund, which is a different kind of index, that's going to be the much smaller funds.
So in other words, an index is kind of like an index in a book. And you say, I can't read all the pages, but this is representative of what's in there if I want it to.
Exactly. And this way, you don't have to be really smart about what stock to buy, what's hot, what's not. You just simply are getting the whole package. And as these stocks, as they change their valuation, it changes the relative position in the index. And so you wind up getting more of things that are profitable and getting less of things that are not as profitable.
When Warren Buffett was asked on TV a year ago, I think it was the Today Show, doesn't matter, but he was on TV, and he would say, the last question he was asked was, if you had to give somebody one piece of financial advice, what would it be? And he said, pick a stock index fund and hold it for at least 20 years. Now, that's Warren Buffett. He's done pretty well.
It's okay.
Yeah. So there you go.
He's one of my students.
Learned a lot from Dave.
Yeah. You taught him when he transferred to FERS.
That's
right.
All righty. That's a very good point about index funds, because the other advantage of index funds are they are incredibly inexpensive to manage by the investment firms that manage those funds. And that's one of my opinion, the greatest advantage of the Thrift Savings Plan. They have the cheapest expense ratios of anybody for those funds.
By far.
Oh, so you could go out to some other company, and I don't want to say names like Vanguard or T. Rowe Price, but I guess I just did. And those same funds are there, but much higher expense ratios than you would pay at the thrift. And expense ratios makes a huge difference. Listeners should take a look on the TSP website, the July 2010 highlights, where it talks about the expense factors, expense ratios in the thrift, and projects that over 20 and 25 years. The difference for some of our listeners here could be over $100,000 more in their account over their career because of the cheaper expense factors.
Expense ratios and taxes are the enemy of creating wealth. And that's not Marxist or anything. That's fact. Yeah. And we've really drilled into the TSP, so if we could kind of summarize it, and then we'll talk about their career as well. I mean, this is, TSP is extremely important. So
absolutely critical.
They have to be aware that it's there. They have to be aware that it's a guaranteed max, but we shouldn't be happy with that. We should go for 5%.
Well, the 5% gives you the max amount of matching. And when you project out, if someone starts in the federal government in their 20s and they wind up retiring in their mid to late 50s, 60 years old, if they only do 5%, but they invest it well, over their career, they actually will wind up being richer in retirement than they were when they were working right before they retired. Okay. It's an amazing thing. Yeah. It's called the power of tax deferred compound and interest, and we all know that.
The miracle of compounding, right?
Right,
John?
That's right.
Albert Einstein, not the comedian, the mathematician.
They were one and the same, weren't they?
No, Albert Brooks, his real name is Albert Einstein.
I did not know that.
Yes,
thank you, John.
You learn stuff when you listen to the show.
That's right.
He obviously felt he had to change it. But no, Albert Einstein, the theory of relativity guy, said he had discovered two miracles in life, and one of them was the miracle of compounding interest. I forget what the other one was, but the one was certainly the miracle of compounding interest.
E equals something.
I think if you, it's the theory of relativity where if you lend your cousin $20, you don't get it back.
Yeah, right.
Isn't that it?
That was it, yes.
Wasn't there another thing that Albert Einstein said? I think he said, you've got to be a genius to figure out income taxes because I have no idea what's going on. That's why we have Bob.
Well, I try. All right. So we got the thrift now, and we got the buckets, and I think you really laid a nice groundwork that, yeah, you're in the G, but you could venture out, and the term risk doesn't mean you're going to lose the money. It just means it isn't guaranteed.
Right.
And if you want to create more wealth, when I use the term wealth, somebody shouldn't think of a multi-gazillionaire. Wealth is how much money can I grow? And if I can grow more by being attentive to this and staying with the program, then that's good. And if I can catch it early, I'm sure both of you all have saw this in the last couple of years, that you saw 30-year-olds in the pre-retirement seminars.
Correct.
And I go up at the break, and I've mentioned this before, and I said, why are you here? I mean, you're certainly entitled to. And to the person, it's, I don't want to mess up early. I want to know now.
Exactly.
Now, of course, we do beginning career seminars, but they don't seem to be as popular as mid-career and ending career. But beyond the thrift, now I've got a job. How do I maximize my job satisfaction if I want to change? And this is going to be really loaded. If I maybe want to change agencies, not because I don't like the one I'm in, but I just maybe like this other one that does something different. What should I look to do so that I can climb the ranks and maybe get a grade increase, step increase? Do I take courses that they offer? If I ever leave federal service, is there an issue with leaving the money in the system versus not? This is really loaded stuff. So let's just do the beginning. I'm looking down the road and I'm saying, I'm happy now, but what should I do to make my position stronger so I can rise in the ranks? Are there many courses that people can take if they work for the feds?
Well, there always have been, and currently, yeah, there are a lot of courses, career development type courses. Of course, you can always go to school on your own at night. I got a master's degree when I was young and working for the government at night and on weekends. They'll send you to courses. You should be proactive in your own training and career development.
Okay. How can you tell when maybe you've plateaued at whatever position or agency that you're in? Maybe we're at a large agency and we're cubbyholed someplace. I won't say game the system. How do I maximize my utility and I want to stay with the feds?
Well, again, to have a conversation with your supervisor, that would be first. I have found that, and I was a supervisor.
You were on both sides.
I was on both sides. I always felt if an employee came to me and expressed an interest in advancing their career, I appreciated that. That told me, hey, this employee is not just content to be a time server. They want not only to help their own career, but that attitude really helps the organization because it shows they feel they can contribute more than they're currently contributing. So have a goal, have a 5-year plan. Don't keep that hidden. Talk to your supervisor, talk to your supervisor's supervisor about it, and make it known that you have interests beyond your current position. I think that's very important, and a lot of most employees don't do that. They're reluctant to do that. They're too shy, is my basic feeling about
okay.
that.
Now, as you worked your way up the ranks, let's say I work for you, and I came to you, John, and I said, John, I really like working for you, but I could do a lateral here that would provide me a greater career path later if I left working
right.
for the
and
agency.
That can be
did you ever take offense to that?
No, that can be an excellent strategy. Take a lateral to the same grade. I've even seen people saying, I will take a lower grade to get in a career ladder that may lead ultimately to a higher position than I would if I'd stayed at my current higher grade. I even saw that. But certainly laterals where you're losing nothing is oftentimes a good strategy. Now, the tricky part is loyalty. I don't care if it's the feds or any business corporation. Loyalty is often rewarded by what I mean by loyalty, longevity. If you're willing to stay at a particular agency for a long period of time throughout your career, you may outlast everybody else and get promoted. But that's kind of hard to determine. The future is unknowable. You may go to another agency. It's usually a lateral, but sometimes it's a promotion. Certainly you should go if it's a promotion. But lateral to another agency and get in a different career path. The key to any success is liking what you're doing. It's not so much the money, although money's important, but it's liking what you're doing. People who like what they're doing usually progress because of that. Because if you like what you're doing, you do a good job.
Okay, Dave, as I progress through, are things I should look at, for example, sick pay? Isn't there a difference between FERS and CSRS when they retire if they've accumulated sick pay? I mean, that's a small thing, but it could be a large thing. Accumulated leave will leave go for a second. But things besides my job satisfaction, I want to build up as many bucks as I can, too. Certainly in the thrift, but we're done with that. Now, outside of that, does it reward me not to take sick leave unless I'm sick?
Well, yeah, obviously it does. Sick leave is, in fact, an incredibly useful tool for the federal employee because, A, there's no limit on the number of hours that one can accumulate and carry over from year to year, unlike the annual leave. Sick leave can wind up being, in a sense, your short-term disability policy. I've always recommended, even before Congress changed the sick leave rules for FERS, I've always recommended that FERS employees save their sick leave. As you're probably aware, sick leave didn't count in FERS retirement for a number of years when it first came out, but it does for CSRS. Well, so they've changed the law, and the law essentially says that although we have a phase-in period through the end of 2013, that beginning 2014 and later, any retirements in those dates, FERS employees will get full credit for their sick leave towards retirement. What does that mean? Well, what it means is that however many hours of sick leave somebody has when they retire, it gets converted into calendar equivalent service time. And the basis is 2,087 hours of unused sick leave equals 1 year of service time. So this would be added into someone's total service, not for qualification to retirement, but for the size of the retirement benefit. Well, there's two things about this. Number one, under FERS, the pension formula is roughly one half of what it is under civil service. So people under the old civil service program get a bigger oomph out of their accrued sick leave than FERS. Number two, people under civil service pay roughly nine times more per pay period into the retirement system than people under FERS. So oftentimes people in civil service, with the value of their sick leave is to also smooth out any extra days in the retirement calculation process that would have been lost. The average CSRS employee these days has probably $200 or more per pay period coming out of their net take-home pay for civil service retirement for the OPM benefit program. Whereas under FERS, it's only 0.8%. So the value of extra days or the amount of money that goes down the drain is significantly less in FERS than it is in civil service. Yet, despite that, I still recommend that FERS employees save their sick leave, not so much for the retirement benefit, but because if you wind up being out and you're going to miss 3, 4, 5, 6 months of work, you would not qualify for OPM disability retirement. That requires a disabling condition where you'd be gone for more than a year. But how would you pay your mortgage? How would you pay your bills? How would you continue to fund your thrift savings plan? Significantly, when you're out on sick leave, you get 100% of pay and benefits. So saving it up is a really great thing to do.
Yes, and ladies, if you're planning on having a child, save your sick leave.
Okay, and a tangent to that, I really like what both of you said there. I would receive my regular compensation. I have the TSP, so I got a lot of dynamics going. But if I also bought a disability policy, such that if I unfortunately become disabled, I'm paying a premium each month and I'd get a certain amount of my compensation through some private plan. However, those premiums reduce based on the time that you would tell the insurance company, I won't put in a claim for 6 months. I won't put in a claim for 9 months. And your premium really goes down. So if you had accumulated sick pay, right, they could carry you through that period. It really makes your disability premiums drop substantially.
Well, that's a very good point, Bob. And I have found a number of interesting things about federal employees when they come on board new, and this disability notion. Disability is something that unfortunately can happen to anybody at any time, you know, unfortunately. However, a federal employee does not have any disability retirement benefit protection from the government until they have 18 months of federal civilian service. Now, notice this does not count military service. So veterans that have applied to become federal employees, their time in the military doesn't count towards the 18 months. That's service that they can buy in towards total retirement, but would not count for the, I guess I'll use the term, vesting period to be eligible for whether it's a FERS retirement benefit, which requires at least 5 years, or the disability or in death and service survivor benefits, which requires 18 months of federal civilian service. So the erstwhile federal employee that's new federal employee that's trying to protect themselves and their family may want to consider getting a private disability insurance policy until they at least have those 18 months of federal civilian service. What Bob said is absolutely correct. Disability policies are cheaper to buy when you're younger and cheaper when there's less risk on the part of the company, less liability on the part of them paying money out. However, most disability insurance policies do contain this coordination of benefit caveat, which is that they pay secondary to any benefits payable from the employer or from Social Security. Oftentimes, I have found that people of, let's say, mid-career, you know, in their 40s, that if they have a disability insurance policy, it's probably not that cost-effective anymore, as long as they've saved sick leave and they have more than 18 months of federal civilian service. They may have that disability aspect covered. They might not be able to get much out of a disability insurance policy from the private industry.
Okay. Good tangent here. So we veered off of the job, but this is important because you want to come back to your job, and now we can, and we can afford to an unfortunate event more readily if we understand the things that could provide us a cash flow should this awful thing happen. Now, let's get back to our career path and our career ladder. I think one of these shows, Mike Causey mentioned that the federal government, there isn't a job category in the world that you can't find in the federal government. So, you know, if you're working in X agency and you want to work on rockets, maybe this is not a great example. I go to NASA, I might want to go into the intelligence community because I gravitate towards foreign languages, or I just want to work there. By the way, we've had a good friend, Ellen McCarthy, come on the show, and she runs an intelligence association. And if you scroll back through, it's probably 6 months ago she was on. It's about time for her to come on again. And she's just captivating. But she's been on both sides. She worked for the federal side, and now she works, and she tells you, okay, these are the special deals that they have. This would be who should apply and who need not apply and the like. This is, again, intelligence community stuff. All righty, so let's come on back now. I've taken my lateral, or I've come back, and I've got my eye on the prize. And the prize is I want to stay here till I retire. As I go through all this, how is retirement calculated for a FERS person? Again, we're talking about new people, so we're probably not talking about CSRS. So how does that work? I'm sure it's years of service, but isn't there a percentage addition, and is there certain exceptions for firefighters and people like that? How does it work?
Right. There's actually, under the FERS retirement system, if we can restrict our conversation mostly there, of course, under the FERS retirement system, an individual to be eligible to retire has to be old enough with enough total years of service. Now, under FERS, because of the bridging in of Social Security back in the mid-1980s to make now federal employees subject to that, because Social Security retirement, full retirement age, was going to be increasing from age 65 to 67, they mimicked that over in FERS, what's called the minimum retirement age, or MRA. And it's based on someone's year of birth, and it's somewhere between 55 and 57 years old. Now, you know, I'll leave it to the listener to find their own minimum retirement age. But if you're born in 1970 or later, it's 57. And that's where it is right now, and there's not been any discussion of raising that any further. So if an individual gets to 57 years old and they want to get what's called an immediate voluntary retirement without any reduction on their age, then they need 30 years of total government service. Now, once somebody goes to retire, they're eligible to retire and they separate, the calculation of their pension benefit is going to be figured usually at 1% of something called the high three average salary for each year of work. Now, the high three average salary is the highest 3 years of pay made in a row in someone's federal government career, and it does include locality pay. So locality pay gets incorporated in that. Even if someone retires and moves to a cheaper cost of living area, they get to take, for example, their Washington, D.C. high three with them. Now, if you had 30 years, that would give you a benefit of 30% of your high three. Now, 30% of high three is not enough to get by on, you know, in regular lifestyle. But when incorporated in with eventually Social Security and, of course, the Thrift Savings Plan, the thought is that one who participates in the thrift over their whole career, hate to keep coming back and hitting that one, but it's true, would be able to have a decent retirement. Keeping in mind that the cornerstone of their retirement is a federal pension benefit paid to them regularly every month for the rest of their life. Now, if the fly-by-night federal government goes out of business, then they lose their pension. But they wouldn't have to pay their mortgage anymore, nor would they have to pay for electricity or food, since there wouldn't be any of that either. And given that the Mayan calendar ticks out at the end of this year.
All righty.
Right. So we don't plan for doomsday of the world. The doomsday we want to avoid is personal doomsday. And that means not having enough money for the rest of our life. That's critical.
And I know I don't want to go back to the thrift, but that ballpark estimate thing you mentioned, even I can do that one. And I do it often.
Yeah. It is a piece of cake. It is such a great starting point because otherwise you can feel totally overwhelmed. And when you're overwhelmed, you'll do nothing.
Exactly. Knowledge is power. That's a cliche, but it's true. It's a cliche because it's true. If you have anxiety about this kind of stuff, the best thing to do is, for example, go to a website like TSP.gov and start educating yourself. An invaluable tool is the TSP calculator. It'll teach you the miracle of compounding interest when you play with it. It's easy to use, as well as the ballpark estimator that Dave has mentioned. If you start using those tools, all of a sudden your knowledge base explodes. And a lot of your anxiety about these financial issues goes away. Because now you know what you're facing, you know what you have to do.
Very, very well put. Can I go back and ask you a question, Dave? With regards to the first person, the age, I think you said, what was it, 57? They have to be at least 57.
And this is for regular employees. We have special employees, too.
We have special. We'll do them in a second.
Okay.
I got to go slow. So I'm 57, I'm FERS, and I've really enjoyed it, but it's time for me to go do something else. And you mentioned Social Security. Now, right. I've been putting in Social Security since I started to work for Uncle, and now I got to wait till I'm 60 what?
Well, 62 is the minimum age to get your Social Security retirement benefit, but that is considered to be early retirement, so you would take a permanent reduction. That means for the rest of your life on the Social Security benefit you would have had if you'd waited until your Social Security full retirement age. Now, there are many, many analyses as to what's the best thing to do. Take your Social Security as soon as you can get your hands on the money, or wait a little longer and get more per month. And I have found that usually the best way to answer that question for people that would be approaching that now would be, are you still working? Because if you're still working, then, of course, you really can't get your Social Security benefit until your full retirement age. Whereas if you're not working, well, what's the old expression about, you know, bird in the hand versus two in the bush?
Okay, but what about my? I'm 57 and I got to wait till 62. Do they give me any? Do they give me anything in that interim period?
They do. They do. If one is not working much after they retire from the federal government, from the ages of MRA for regular employees up until 62, there's a thing called a FERS Special Retirement Supplement. The FERS Special Retirement Supplement is something computed by the Office of Personnel Management, and in a sense, it tries to replicate the amount of Social Security benefit earned from your FERS civilian employment. Interestingly, veterans here, those that have some active duty service but have not retired from active duty, although that military service can be bought in as additional federal service to qualify and calculate your pension, it would not be used in the calculation of the FERS Special Retirement Supplement. But an individual, oftentimes, to get an estimate of what that supplement would be, if you have an estimate of what your age 62 Social Security check would be, multiply that by the fraction, the years of FERS civilian service divided by 40. What percent of a 40-year career did you spend as a FERS civilian? Multiply that times your expected age 62 Social Security check, and that's about what your supplement's going to be.
Will that harm me with future Social Security when I do become of age?
It will not, other than an individual who decides to work after they retire from the federal government. Their excess wages, and the excess wages are kind of small, this year $14,640. If they earn beyond that, they start losing some of their supplemental benefit. Now, if someone does not work, then of course they're going to get their supplement. But then their Social Security benefit may be a little smaller because of that lack of additional employment. Social Security anticipates that people will work from age 22 to age 62.
Okay,
40
so
years.
If I'm kind of in that gap between whatever and 62, I'm going to get a supplement, but it is going to be paid by OPM, and it's going to be on
correct.
The OPM form and not as Social Security.
That's correct.
Right.
And again, it has no effect really on the amount of Social Security benefit one will get later.
The average supplement is about $8,000 a year. Additional added to your FERS annuity, so it's not inconsequential.
But
now,
it does.
People have been reading that this supplement may be done away with. Now, it hasn't happened yet, and we don't know if it will, but it's a possibility. So there may be a day when there will be no supplement if Congress...
And we'll be right on top of that.
Except it looks like they're going to exempt. If they do that, they will exempt law enforcement, firefighters, and air traffic controllers. The special provision, they would still continue to get the supplement. But the so-called regular employees are possibly facing the elimination of the supplement. Now, they may grandfather that. So if you're a current federal employee, maybe you get a break. But the current proposal, as I recall from reading Mike Causey, is that people retiring after 2013, I think, or maybe it's this year. I think it's this year. This is just a proposal. Hasn't happened yet. Would not get the supplement. So if you retire, if the current proposal holds and is codified into law, you'd have to retire by December 31st of this year to get a supplement. But hasten to add, hasn't happened yet, may not happen.
Okay. Well, we got about 5 minutes left, so let's bring it down to a real slow landing. So we've marched through the different phases, and now we're looking out at, okay, I can or I can't. But looking downstream, with the people that both of you have met and counseled over your careers, what do you tell them? You know, if they like their job, don't leave, run out the door, go to a second career. Do you find that some have a skill that's very attractive on the outside and they could potentially maybe not make as much in retirement from the federal side, but they could go to work as a second career in private industry, which is heartless, but you could probably make more initially. But do you ever get somebody that's on the fence? They're not mad at the world. They're not mad at their job, but they're going, gee, I can do this. They've got to understand cost of living. And, you know, you talk about the miracle of compounding. It works in the reverse there. The cost of living is also subject to the rules of the miracle of compounding.
Well, there's one area that I'm very adamant in my counseling, federal employees that are not quite yet eligible to retire. And this is something that John and I have talked about over years and years, and that is the ability to have the federal health insurance package in retirement, which is subsidized for the rest of your life, guaranteed, non-cancelable. It is one of the most awesome insurance benefits that anyone can have in the entire country. According to the Department of Labor, most people that work in this country work for organizations that provide zero health insurance to the retirees. It's just not profitable to do so. The federal government doesn't believe that way, at least for now. And that is, if one can get an immediate retirement out of the federal government, they can stay in that federal health insurance if they meet just a few other rules. But that's the big one. So the question that I usually focus people in and on would be this. Are you eligible to retire yet for immediate retirement? No. You really ought to stay put until you get to that point. Now, once somebody is eligible to retire and they've got other aspirations, then that, yeah, it can make sense for them to leave at that point in time and go chase those other dreams and occupations and goals. But get, you know, always make sure you've got that great set of benefits lined up for you. And again, that health insurance, it's one of the best. It is the best in the entire country.
And it's protection for your spouse as well.
Right. All right,
for the rest of his or her life,
potentially. And it's the same health insurance that members of Congress have.
May I ask you another question?
Yes.
Let's say that I did work for Uncle for 5 or 8 years, many, many years ago.
Right.
And I really liked my job, but I was wooed out of the public sector and I went to the private sector. Do I have any chance to get any kind of deferred annuity or pension when I do hit of age?
You do. Once you have 5 years, you're vested for federal retirement benefits if you did not take your money out of the system. If you take your money out of the system, what you have to do is come back into the federal government to reestablish the right to that service.
When we're talking about money out of the system, that's not the thrift.
It's the pension.
That's a very small amount.
It's that 0.8%. Okay, right. Dave was talking about.
Yeah, but this also applies to people many, many years ago that were in the government under civil service, much as my wife, who spent 7 years with the FBI under CSRS.
Okay.
And if she can come back in, she can wind up getting a federal retirement benefit eventually.
Is that a subtle message over the radio?
That sort of was.
Okay. Anyway, we got less than a minute. John?
Well, as always, contribute to the TSP as much as you can. If you can do up to $17,000 this year, which is the IRS limit, that's great. Absolutely invest in the TSP as much as you possibly can.
Okay, and Dave, besides going to Leonard Skinner shows, what else advice could you give?
Well, of course, always learn from history. As anyone knows me, knows I'm a big history fan. However, I would say this, that what you need to do is do the ballpark estimate, find out how much you need to save, then build your budget, and build your budget in the obvious steps, getting rid of high-interest consumer credit card debt first, and then give yourself a reward, and then move on down the line at all those other things. And don't forget, Section 529 plans for your kids' college education.
And listen next week, because we're going to talk about the Roth TSP. Bye-bye. See you next week.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.